It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about the process of self-discovery and reinvention that follows a career that ends suddenly. That sudden ending of a career might be called first death, but it's usually followed by a second life. And this conversation this hour was inspired by a panel that took place at the Witching Hour Festival in Iowa City last fall. And we have many of those panelists here with us today. This hour, I'll talk with two former professional dancers, Leslie Nolte and Shumpe Yamaki. Also, former pro football player Nate Kading will join us, and former music teacher Debbie Brooks. We also want to hear from you. Is this a process that you've gone through in your life? Share your story. Call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to start the hour with Leslie Nolte, who is founder and artistic director of the Nolte Academy of Dance and Performing Arts Preschool in Coralville, and a former professional dancer herself. Hello, Leslie.
Good morning, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming back to the show. And all right, let's go back in time. You've been dancing for a very long time. When did you decide that you wanted to become a professional dancer?
You know, when you start when you're three, it's a hobby, and it's something that your parents bring you to. I knew in about eighth grade that I wanted to spend all of my hours of the week doing it. And then I knew sophomore year when I got my first professional job in high school that this was what, you know, it was what I knew I wanted to do, but I also knew dance was an early career type thing, so it wasn't one of those things that I could wait too long. You have to commit a little bit early as a dancer just for all of the physical reasons. And that's not necessarily true for everybody involved, but the competition is pretty harsh out there. So sophomore year in high school is when I gave up everything else and danced 7 days a week. And that was when I knew that that was when my goals and my ladder of the pegs that I needed to accomplish to get to where I wanted to go, that's sort of the time it started.
So you were dedicating all time outside of school, basically, to dance, and you started climbing that ladder. Where did you go? How did your career progress?
I got a lot of jobs in high school and over the summer times. What we called them, they were called industrials. So it would be big shows in the city of Chicago where you would dress up in Adidas clothing, for instance, and that's how they would introduce their next year's clothing. So we started with jobs like that, which was very fun. A couple, you know, background videos, music videos, things like that. And then I knew I wanted to dive more into the modern dance. So I came to the University of Iowa. And from there, I was having a really lovely, you know, dance career here at the University of Iowa with DIC and the galas, of course, on the old Hanter stage and things like that. And I was on stage with DIC, and I tore my ACL. 3 years later, I was on stage again, and I tore my other ACL. And that was at the point where it was like, I think this is just a bigger peg to get across.
Right. So you were determined to overcome that obstacle.
Absolutely. Both of those times.
What were other people in your life saying to you?
My father was like, okay, there's warning number one. You have bad knees. You should not be counting on this for your livelihood. Okay, there's warning number two, Leslie. Do I need to repeat this conversation? He would remind me of how great my math scores were in high school, you know, to try to get me to shift gears. And it really wasn't until after that second ACL surgery, I found Pilates. And I was the strongest dancer and performer I had ever been. And I was getting a lot of good attention in Chicago with auditions. Of course, I was on my way back from all the rehab. So I was having a lot of good attention. I had a couple really great auditions in New York. And then Mark and I, although living separately,
right,
my husband, Mark, and I, we got pregnant. And that was sort of the third, oh, my God, now my path really has to have a decision to be made. And at that point, Iowa was that decision. And I knew, and I remember this conversation with Mark. We were driving across the Mississippi River, and it was in the year 1999. And I said, promise me only 2 years. It'll take me that long to really get back to my best self so my dance career as a performer can continue. And we pinky swore in our little green Cavalier at the time. And, you know, lo and behold, we never left, of course. But I remember thinking at that time, there is nothing in Iowa for a professional dancer. This is the worst place I could be, and what am I going to do? And there were many, many years, obviously, as a new mom, the emotion probably was tripled because of all of that. And like I mentioned at the Witching Hour Festival, looking back, I think I was angry. I was probably angry and getting over it, and maybe a little angry at Mark when it came time to, you know, when the bad parts of things were happening, I'd look at him and say, why are we in Iowa? And I think looking back, I was mad for like 8 years.
Wow.
I mean, I really, in hindsight, I wouldn't have known that going through it. So sometimes I feel guilty. In the first 8 years here, of course, I had my first three children, and I had an incredible school that was growing by the day. But getting over that idea my whole life that being a teacher was second rate to being the professional dancer that my brain said I was going to be my whole life was really a self-discovery that I'm only starting to understand now that I'm taken out of it, and am so thankful for the path that did appear in front of me and that we did create here in Iowa.
During that time, obviously, with three kids and a new business, and we'll talk more about what you threw yourself into in this second life, but what made it particularly hard for you? I mean, you had this cohort, you had these peers that you had grown up with and trained with. Was that the most difficult part, watching them pursue their careers?
Absolutely. I would see someone get a spot in a company, and I remember being 24 years old and watching a piece saying, that was my spot, you know? And it was hard. It's hard to admit now how sort of judgmental I was, thinking, well, I know I was more talented, so that's a spot I should have had. At the same time, I'm looking at these beautiful children and this beautiful studio, and I had lovely kids to teach every single day. But there was that part of me that just said, this isn't fair. I didn't get to do that one part I really thought I was supposed to do, I was going to do, I was good enough to do. And that was very hard and sad. As a dancer, you grow up to perform. You don't grow up to teach. You know, of course I love.
And you were going to have your own touring company. I mean, your dreams were not just big. They were really big.
They were really big. And it's one of those things that, thank goodness those three things happened and I am where I am now. I have to say that one of the times that I really started to heal for all of this was sort of my late 20s, early 30s, when all of those peers started retiring. And it felt like we were now back in the same part of life. And it's in no way do I mean it in a negative way for them, but it was like, oh, well, now they're starting their life over and they don't know what to do. And I'm already
You already did
here,
that.
You know? So it emotionally, I think as a female, as a mother, I tell my kids now, what do you want to do first? So they don't commit to that one thing their whole life in their brain. You know, what's something you want to do first? And I've sort of changed the conversation with my students and with my own family, now of five children, to say, let's just think about what you want to do first. So maybe I can save them and some of my students from what could happen. You know, you never know, especially when you're dealing with something physical.
You've also drawn on your personal experience, your training, and your injuries in creating a dance studio and a way of teaching dance that really prepares students for the toll that dancing can take on your body. How do you use your experiences as a teacher and as a business owner?
Well, there's some things that people would never notice that we do that are so important to me to protect the children. All of our floors, for instance, much more expensive of a route than I could have gone, but all of our floors are lifted off the ground by about 3.5 inches because I didn't want knee injuries. I mean, ultimately, our classes have teachers that are trained or went through their own injuries. We have the Pilates. We teach dance kinesiology. I know that I didn't learn correct rotation before I came to the University of Iowa, and I think that's a shame. And we're not going to let that happen to these kids that are growing up with these big dreams.
So you can prepare these young people to take the path that you wanted to take without the injuries, is your hope?
That is my hope. Correct training could have saved me a couple times. I mean, two incredibly silly bad landings. And we talk a lot about what you choose in your life within our classes. And almost always we say, here's your professional dance career, yes. But think about, do you love teaching? Do you love choreography? Do you love physical therapy? Do you love human anatomy? You know, there's so many things outside of professional dancing on a stage that would keep dance in your life. And we talk a lot about that in our classes.
That I was going to ask you that because, you know, for so many young people, when they start dancing, when they find something that they really love, those big dreams do get ignited. And you want to encourage the dreams, but how do you balance that with a dose of reality and practicality without bursting somebody's bubble?
And sometimes it's the brains that are hearing it. So, you know, we had a story the other day. One of our old students had an audition in New York, and there were 850 females that showed up for one spot. And we had that conversation. You know, you have to be in your best physical shape, but your brain has to be ready. You are one of 800 females vying for one spot. So if you aren't that 5% that are going to get paid and create a livelihood in the world of dance, think about this entire bubble around all of this education you're getting that could keep you involved in some way. We have some dancers now working backstage that love it. You know, they transformed everything that they know into now sort of the technical team, and no dance company can function without that technical team. I remind people in our classroom how important the whole spectrum is. But again, for me, it took 10 years of being angry and parts of sad to get to this spot. And I hope that I can give people some mechanisms within their dance brain that at least would shorten that period of time if, in fact, their first goal and career and dream is sort of cut short.
This hour, we're talking about when a career is cut short. Some people call it the first death. We're also talking about that second life. What comes after a career is cut short? With me this hour, Leslie Nolte. She's founder and artistic director of the Nolte Academy of Dance and Performing Arts Preschool in Coralville. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll also talk to former professional football player Nate Kading, Tshumpa Yamaki. He's a potter, but a former dancer. And Debbie Brooks, who is a former music teacher. That's coming up in a moment on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about what happens when a career is cut short. I have with me this hour two former professional dancers, a former professional football player, and a former music teacher. All of them, their careers were cut short for one reason or another. Some people call that first death, and we're focusing on the period that comes after that, that period of self-discovery and reinvention that may be called second life. I've been talking with Leslie Nolte. She's the founder and artistic director of the Nolte Academy of Dance and Performing Arts Preschool in Coralville. She'll stay with us. And I also want to bring Debbie Brooks into the conversation now. These days, she's the pianist for the Tap Show Choir and Discovery Choruses in Cedar Rapids. She's a former music teacher. Hello, Debbie. Oh, I guess Debbie's not with us yet on the phone. We will talk with her in a little while. So I'll bring Nate Kading into the conversation next. Nate Kading is the Iowa City Downtown District Retail Development Coordinator, but many people know him for his professional football career with the San Diego Chargers. Of course, he's a well-known Iowa Hawkeye as well. Hello, Nate.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And all right, growing up, playing football, the dream is to become an NFL player. When did that become your dream?
Well, I was always kind of the skinny, slow kid out on the field, for sure, so I kind of had to find my way and where the fit was at. Started playing soccer at a young age and kicking the soccer ball around and learning how to do that.
I'm sorry, we're having some microphone problems. We're going to move Shempe's mic over to you.
Yeah, sorry about that. There we go. Now we're rolling.
Yep.
Just grew up and I was slow and too skinny to do anything else along the way. So kind of found my niche with kicking the ball. Started on the soccer fields and then worked that into football and went through high school and had some success and got a scholarship at the University of Iowa and just kind of became almost obsessive compulsive with it. And if I was out on the field one day in practice and kicked 50 field goals and made 40, I wanted to find some way the next day I went out to make 41 and really just kind of fell in love with the competitive aspect of it. And one thing kind of led to the other and led to a professional professional career out in California with the NFL.
Now, you know, so many young people do want to be professional, whatever, basketball players, football players. And it's a little bit like winning the lottery if you make it through that college career and then make it to that professional level. Do you remember kind of the moment when you allowed yourself to dare to dream that that could be me?
Yeah, a little bit. I was always kind of the mindset was just sort of like the immediate goal in front of you, and you knock that off, you do the next thing, and eventually kind of pick up some momentum and get to it. But about halfway through my college career here at the University of Iowa, kind of, you know, taking my lumps as a lot of kickers do, where, you know, you miss some field goals and you learn from those and you improve, and really started getting some really good momentum about halfway through, and you kind of start thinking, okay, this is something that I might be able to be exceptionally good at, and just that just led to bigger and better things. But the interesting thing for me through my professional football career is with kicking especially is it's a very non-transferable skill set. So once I describe myself as kind of a one-trick pony. I mean, I'm kicking an oblong ball through two posts. I mean, you're not going to make a whole lot of money doing that other than on a professional football field. So you learn that pretty quick, but you got to jump all in and do that and have that laser focus on that one thing. And, so it really has to have been a reinvention after that. Once that skill set is no longer needed.
So now, of course, everybody knows a professional sports career can't last forever, although kickers may have a little more longevity than many other players on a football team. But did you already think while you were playing football, did you think of what do I want to do next ever?
You do a little bit of that. As a kicker, you have a lot more idle time than everybody else. Everybody else is learning plays and doing a lot of those things. So you got a lot of time to think about it. And while we were out in San Diego, we always made we came back here to Iowa, to Iowa City, where I was born and raised. My wife's from Marshalltown, Iowa. So we made a point of remaining involved in this community and had been a part of starting a couple of small businesses in and around downtown. So really kind of took some interest in that. And I actually found, even all the way back into college, that the more that I sort of put my eggs in baskets other than sports, actually that helped me be a better athlete, kind of took my mind, not only taking my mind off it, but it helped me identify less with just being an athlete or a football player. Because as a kicker, as everybody knows, there's a lot of pressure with that. So if your whole identity, you know, weighs on whether the kick goes in or out of the uprights, that can be a great thing when you're the star and you kick the game-winning field goal. But it can be, as you can imagine, an awful thing if you happen to miss. And then now your full identity is known for the guy that blew the team the game or lost the game. So you learn that pretty early on when you go through some of those negative moments that, man, I better be a really good friend or really, you know, be good at school and have some other things I'm interested in because I don't want to be just identified as this football player. So I think looking back on my athletic career, that was really a benefit, of, especially being a kicker where it's just black and white, the success and the failures. For me, it was be able to have that perspective, and it urged me early on to make sure that I was applying myself and really passionate about things outside of just football.
Now, we were just talking about Leslie's dancing career, and knee injuries were the thing that had to send her in a different direction there, at least a big part of that equation. It was your knee for you also.
Yeah, too many bad ACLs here today in the room.
So what happened?
Yeah, well, I was doing something that any kicker shouldn't do, trying to tackle someone. It was I remember it very vividly. It was the opening game, the opening play of the 2012 football season out in San Diego. I did the whole national anthem, and that's kind of like probably the most nervous moment that every football player is. You have the whole buildup of the offseason, the 5, 6, 7 months, and you're getting ready to kicking it off. Everybody's excited. You know, they had this big, it was one of the anniversaries, September 11th, so they had this big bald eagle that flew down off the top of the stadium. You know, you're excited, you kick the ball off and you run down there, and just like a lot of ACLs in sports, it was a non-contact thing. I just kind of tried to plant my leg in a way that I could try to make a move and tackle the guy, and it just blew my ACL out. So it was really this surreal type experience, and it was kind of, that really was sort of the beginning of the end of my career. I worked my way back and played the first 5 games of the next season with the Chargers, and then started having a bunch of groin injuries with my kicking leg, and missed a few more games and finished that season in Miami. Then got signed with Tampa Bay and had to tore my groin again. So if you don't have a functional groin as a kicker, it's not a good thing. So one thing kind of led to the next, and kind of found myself in that May of 2013, kind of looking up at the ceiling, like, what am I going to do now? Because I kind of figured, like you had mentioned, as a kicker, my career would have gone a little bit longer, and kind of had to think about what the next steps were.
So you knew you wanted to come back to Iowa. At least you had maintained these connections in Iowa. How did you decide? What was that discovery process like for you of deciding where you would go next?
Yeah, I think the where was pretty easy. Just my wife and I's connections back to Iowa. I think the what was the tricky part. I think looking back on it now, it's about 3 years in the rearview mirror. I think the best decision I made, which I'm lucky to be back here to have a lot of mentors and people that would, you know, advising me, and I could, you know, did a lot of coffee and soul searching and talking with people, was I had the self-awareness enough and the good advice from people to say I needed to take a step or two back before hopefully I took a couple, three steps forward instead of just jumping into something. So I applied to the University of Iowa to the MBA at Tippie University, and they had a great two-year MBA program. So that, I think, was in hindsight the best decision for me because it allowed me the opportunity to kind of sharpen my toolkit a little bit to learn about business in a variety of different settings and different things, but then also kind of hit the pause button for a couple of years and really learn about business in a variety of different settings, a bunch of different fields and industries, because like I said, I had really no idea what exactly it is I wanted to do, and really start to develop strengths that could be applied somewhere out into the world or to a business or an organization or a cause. So that when the aha moment happened for me during those 2 years of school is when I stopped thinking about what was it that I wanted to do and instead started thinking about what is it that I can become good at? What strength can I develop that can be applied somewhere? And I think that to me was where I kind of started, okay, I can really find some reward from this second career is by, you know, bringing value and plugging that into somewhere out there in the world beyond sports. So, and then just started developing that skill set.
Did you go through a period of anger and depression when you realized that NFL career wasn't going to continue?
Yeah, I think so. I think it wasn't like a real stark thing, but I think it was sort of this prolonged kind of transformation through a bunch of different things. I think looking back on it, and still a little bit for sure, is I think the trickiest thing for me was, you know, as a football player, you're very much in the public, especially professional and here in Iowa with the Hawkeyes, you're very much in the public realm, and, you know, people know you as Nate, the guy, the football player. And then all of a sudden that's kind of taken out from under you. So I think at first it was difficult for me to look at people and then knowing that they're looking back at you knowing, okay, now what is Nate now? He's no longer that football. He's that ex-football player. And that just kind of, you know, rubbed me the wrong way because, you know, I didn't want to be just known as the guy that used to do something. So I think it took.
Although with how Hawkeyes are revered in this town, I mean, hero status that's going to last forever.
Yeah, they still got that competitive itch that you still want to, you know, the next thing, do those sort of things. So I think it was tough for me to kind of deal with how other people looked at me. And then also, you know, then once I kind of started peeling the layers off the onion, I had that feeling too. You know, I think deep down inside I identified myself at the core as Nate, the football player too. It's hard not to do that. So you start just, it's that kind of, you know, the identification of both externally and internally and starting to work through that. And that's, I think for me, and I'm not a patient person, if it's been hard, my wife reminds me of that frequently, is it's a process. It's not something that just like, you know, one day you're this, next day you're that. It's just sort of over time it happens and you do things and things change and you try to, you know, create different things out in the world that are relevant to people in society. And then, that, you know, the way you identify yourself changes and vice versa from other people. So I think just kind of doing that and finding those things, but really looking back on having school, something that I could wake up with and have that purpose for those 2 years that kind of helped as that transition was very helpful.
Yeah. I'm talking with Nate Kading. He is Iowa City Downtown District Retail Development Coordinator and, of course, a former professional football player. We're talking about that transition when a career ends suddenly. And I do have Debbie Brooks on the line now. As I mentioned earlier, she's the pianist for Tap Show Choir and Discovery Choruses in Cedar Rapids, a former music teacher. Hello, Debbie.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us and for joining us from your vacation today. Debbie, you always knew that you loved music, that music was going to be a part of your career, and you'd actually prepared yourself to be a music teacher, right?
Yeah, since kindergarten, I knew that's exactly what I wanted to do, and my whole life up to that point was focused on going to college, getting my degree, and teaching music, and that's the path I followed.
So how long were you a music teacher, doing exactly what you wanted to do?
I taught at Taft Junior High for the first part of my career, and then when that went to part-time, I went over to Hoover Elementary and taught music, and so I did it. There was never a day that I didn't love going to work. It was everything I thought it would be. So I loved it.
And I'm sure it's what you thought you would do for the rest of your life, but then something happened in 1982. What happened?
Yes. I had just a routine ear surgery where they had to recrimp a prosthesis, and when the doctor was in there, he was scraping scar tissue and accidentally ruptured my oval window, which caused me to go permanently deaf on that ear. And then also I lost my ability to walk. And about a year later, then I went down to the University of Iowa and they did a vestibular nerve sever, which I had to relearn to walk again.
Wow. And, you know, with all that you were dealing with at that point, you were also dealing with a huge change as a musician. When did you realize that you weren't going to be able to be a music teacher?
Well, as long as I had the one ear, I thought I was good, even though I couldn't hear in stereo, and I just kept plugging away at it. When I got back to teaching, I really didn't have a very good sense of balance, so the dance aspect of what I was doing had to kind of be left to the side. And then what happened is then I was in a very severe car accident where a lady hit me, and it exacerbated something else in my other ear, and I started losing hearing in my other ear. Mm-hmm. And so I realized one day when a little boy had his hand up, and for about five different things, I kept asking him to repeat himself, and he was so excited to share. And then finally he just said, never mind.
Oh.
And that broke my heart, and I realized I have to quit teaching.
You then went into a career as a neuromuscular therapist. What led to that career change?
The car accident that I was in. And it brought up a thought in my mind. My grandma told me when I was little, she said, you be thankful for everything, even the things that don't seem so good. Always be thankful, and you will always be happy. And so I saw what she was meaning when I had this really bad car accident that caused a lot of neck and head problems for me. And it ended up being the career that I'd never even heard of that I went into to help people that had soft tissue injuries. And I worked on a lot of athletes and people that had chronic pain and that weren't getting help anywhere else. So I did that for quite a long time, too.
During that transition, we've talked about some of the very difficult feelings people can go through when their career is ended because of something outside of their control. Was there a lot of struggle, a lot of frustration, a lot of anger for you?
Well, I never felt the anger or depression, but I just was heartbroken when I had to leave music because my whole idea in life was to share the joy of music and my passion to every student I ever had. That was my total goal. And to leave that was very, very hard. However, I wasn't fearful either because I remember that my grandma said, always everything will work out if you really just keep applying yourself. And so I didn't get fearful. I started taking the classes on neuromuscular therapy while I was still teaching not because I was thinking it was a new career. It was because it was fascinating to me that you could help people in pain.
So you really found a new passion to turn to.
Yeah, I did. I was so fortunate, and it was because of something that appeared to be not a good thing, a bad car accident, that actually put me into a new career.
Now, we've been talking about Second Life. You're also on your third life as well, because you were part of that career for, 20 years or so, and then there was another car accident. What happened?
A lady hit me with her car, and it broke my hand, and so I could not push or pull with my hand anymore to do the work. And so the good thing out of all of this is I was able to still glide. That means I could play the piano. And so as I left neuromuscular therapy, I started just accepting jobs where I was playing the piano. And the irony is, in my younger years, I was not known as a pianist. I was known as a vocalist. I sang professionally and on stage and everything. And I ended up being a piano player. But I'm still working around and The other irony is I'm back at Taft playing for the show choir that I actually started back when I taught at Taft. There was not a show choir, and I started one there. And I'm back playing as the accompanist for Discovery Chorus, which I was the original accompanist for Discovery Chorus for the symphony in Cedar Rapids.
Wow. Well, Debbie, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
You're welcome.
Debbie Brooks is a pianist for the Tap Show Choir and Discovery Choruses in Cedar Rapids, now on her third career, her third reinvention. We're talking about what happens when a career is cut short today, and we will continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about when careers are cut short by a circumstance beyond the control of the person who is pursuing that career. Many people call that first death. And this hour, I've been talking with Leslie Nolte. She's a former professional dancer and founder and artistic director of the Nolte Academy of Dance in Coralville. Nate Kading is also here with me, former professional football player. And now he is Iowa City Downtown District Retail Development Coordinator. I was just talking with Debbie Brooks a moment ago, who was a music teacher and had that career cut short, and then a neuromuscular therapist and had that career cut short as well. And now another former dancer, now a potter, is here with me. Shumpe Yamake is a potter and resident artist at Scattergood Friends School and Farm, and he's also on the studio art faculty at Grinnell College. Hello, Shumpe.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And dance was your passion. What were your goals?
Dance was my passion, but it wasn't professional. I was intrigued by the street dance. I saw the music videos, and I was really intrigued by the hip-hop, house, and capoeira. And capoeira is Afro-Brazilian martial arts. And then when I look at those things in life now, going back to the, you know, when I was, I'm from Japan, and when I was in Japan, I'm teaching high school right now, but my least favorite subject was English. Then I came here to talk in the radio. Sort of amazing to me right now.
Pretty amazing journey.
So,
absolutely.
So in that time, when I came to the United States in 21, but I never really had any passion to be like a professional dancer. I just intrigued by it. And then I wanted to go clubs and, okay, I want to be sort of a rock star in the club. So therefore, I need to learn like in deep roots of hip-hop dance. That's why I chose to be in Philadelphia. That was 1996. Then I started to go to school. But in a school in Philadelphia, was required to go in the daytime, and then I had to skip those classes because my passion was to learn dance. So I was in the clubs till like 4 and 5 in the morning. Then I came back to the home like 8, and I couldn't wake up the next day, or in the same day.
So you were pursuing an education in two different ways, but they were getting in the way.
The reason is just because I was a student. I had a student visa. Mm-hmm. So then I moved to Wisconsin to be just a full-time student.
So your passion was dance. You were pursuing dance and had some pretty big dreams as the next rock star hip-hop artist.
Right.
But then that passion was taken away from you. What happened to you?
I had a car accident, and same as Davey. I got hit by a drunk driver.
You were hit by a drunk driver.
I got severe injury in my arm, and I torn PCL, I think, in the back of the ligaments and my knee. So I had to sort of stop dancing.
So when you were in the hospital, that was one of your first questions for the doctor, right?
Yeah, I backflip again? That was my bad.
Can I backflip again? And what did he say?
He said, yes, if you work hard to rehabilitate. So it took about a year to fully recover. And by that time, that my sort of a formal physical therapy program was pottery. my mom actually suggested I should take pottery class because I was really into, you know, working in clay when I was in elementary school.
Oh, really? So she remembered back to when you were a little kid and said, you loved this. You should do it again and it will help you.
Yes. So, yeah.
So in taking those classes, learning to be a potter as an adult, that became your new passion. What do you think you find connections between dance and pottery? What do you think drew you into pottery as an adult artist?
I think it's mentors. There are mentors I met. And Richard Brisenahan, who lives in Minnesota, St. John's, Minnesota, in Collegeville in Minnesota. And I was there for a year and a half as an apprentice. I think that he taught me how to become potter and how to be in a potter as an sort of full-time. Then that's when I really into the pottery. So it wasn't really like, you know, I love clay, so I wanted to go. I just, you know, intrigued by the life he did. So I just followed him. Yeah.
And you have said that working with pottery, shaping it with your body, has some similarities to dance. How is it similar?
It is very similar because the pottery, when I throw pots, that's you imprinting, you're tracing, you leave the trace of how you move into the clay. That became the shape of the pottery. So that's what I feel like. And if I move smooth enough, that I can show the line of pottery can be more graceful. That's what I feel. They feel the same connection between pottery and dance.
So it's almost like a permanent record of your dance.
Correct.
Now, you had this wonderful mentor. You enjoyed the pottery. But at the same time, you did leave this passion for dance, this dream of dancing behind. What did you have to go through to be able to let that go?
Yeah, you know, technically, I never really let that
really?
Go.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I'm still dancing. I'm still actually teaching in the PE class in Skagit. So my dance passion is still here, and I would never let that go.
After going through a serious accident like you went through, a lot of people have to go through that, whatever their careers are,
right,
when they have a serious accident.
Sure.
You've talked about how letting go of the anger about that accident allowed you to move forward. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, my take the life is the it's that if things happen, incident happen to you, that doesn't really mean that's the end of your life. That life goes on. Then how you take that incident to your way to learn, I think that's the most important part. So that accident was sort of, you know, dramatic issue to me. But still after that, there's life goes on. What can I learn from it? And that's what I found out. So everything happens right now in my life still. That leads me to the next step. And then I don't really count on it. That's at the end of the life.
Did you have to do something to be able to let go of anger, to not hold on to the frustration of having something that you had no control over happen
yes,
to you?
Yeah, that happens quite often in my life. But I just feel to be positive and then not saying the words that makes me not feel comfortable. So that thing, I think that's the one of the things I learned. So just not feeling anger, not feeling disappointed and depressed, and just feel just part of life. And then, you know, there is a light and black, and a light and dark, and always black and white. So there's a swinging. Your life is swinging all the time.
I'm talking with Chumpe Yamaki. He is a potter, resident artist at Scattergood Friends School and Farm, and on the studio art faculty at Grinnell College. Also with me, Nate Kading, Iowa City Downtown District Retail Development Coordinator, and Leslie Nolte, founder and artistic director of the Nolte Academy of Dance and Performing Arts Preschool in Coralville. And we're talking about first death, when a career is ended suddenly, and that reinvention, that act of finding your next act in life. And I want each of you to have an opportunity to weigh in together, because you all went on these very personal journeys as you have continued and talked to each other and talked to other people. Do you see parallels between what you went through and the transitions that other people make, even if they weren't in a performance or a sport where that kind of transition is expected? Leslie?
Absolutely. I have a lot of conversations even with parents in my lobby where, you know, the kids graduate old enough that maybe they want to stop, they want to change from being a stay-at-home mom. And there's that fear and bravery saying, well, I had that life. I chose absolutely and happily to be a stay-at-home mom, and now I want my old life back. You know, I've had a lot of conversations like that where I think sometimes they're asking, how do you be a working mom? That might be the conversation they're having with me. But I always do feel like encouraging them to be brave, not to underestimate what they still do know, what they know even more from what they've done. I think a lot of it is built out of fear of the I can't. And I know that from all of us at the table, when we thought we were this one thing, there were so many things I could have listed that I couldn't do. Well, in fact, I could. I just didn't know it yet. And discovering that you're able to do more than what you've set your mind at what you're going to be is a big deal. And when you discover that it's not that scary to change that path, to sort of hop on a train, maybe going the other way, it's very rewarding. And I like to have that conversation with people and engage in, let's do something, you know.
Yeah, I think Debbie's grandma's advice is sage in the sense, and Leslie was hitting at this a little bit too, is that for me, right when I got to football, there was this point where I was just kind of wallowing in my own sorrow, like, you know, I'm 32 and I wanted to play football until I was 40. Or do you just think of it like Debbie's grandma and say, this is a great opportunity to kind of, who else has the chance to kind of have a bunch of different things in front of them, and you can pick and choose and have a new career at 32. This is exciting, and yeah, it's going to be challenging, but what a great opportunity. So it's kind of, you know, flipping the paradigm a little bit, and instead of sort of viewing it as a negative, but also how these other awesome opportunities might open up in front of you. And, you know, here in Iowa City, you got a lot of chance to talk to a lot of college students in different classes and lectures. I was just up at Mount Vernon and Cornell and talked to all their student athletes. And there's a lot of, I think, angst amongst some of the kids that are 20, 21, 22, and they've gone to school and they're focusing on one particular subject, but they may have taken an internship and they went in that office and like, I don't know if I can see myself doing this for X amount of years. And, you know, so my encouragement to them is stop thinking about like you need to plan the next 20, 30, 40 years. Think about, you know, what is it, how you can have value and how exciting it might be to go in and learn in some new field or do whatever you're going to do, and think about how that is going to be and have that positive outlook and mentality on it instead of like, man, I got to solve all the world's problems here right now today, and just kind of take it and kind of see what the future might open up for you.
Champagne, do you have something to add?
Yeah, it is scary to start something new and change your life beforehand. But my dad always told me, whenever you start, it's never too late and never too early. So when you feel like you started, when you feel like you need to start, that's a time that you need to start. So I would feel, I would suggest that people to just follow your instinct and feel that, you know, follow your excitement.
You all have these tremendous positive attitudes, which, you know, obviously is a help to you. And you've all impressed me with your ability to take on huge projects, new ideas, tackle something that other people may see as impossible. And Leslie, you and I are part of the same community. We have a lot of the same mom friends. Our kids go to the same school. And you should hear how people talk about you.
Oh, dear.
How does she do it? How 5 kids,
I will give you the
studio,
list of things I don't do well,
but
anytime.
But, you know, you do things that other people see as impossible. And a lot of us have this fear of failure when we try new things. Can you think about what helped you overcome that fear? Was there something that made it possible for you to tackle things in spite of the odds?
I think at the beginning, I was so interested in proving that I could do it, that nothing that came in my way was going to stop me. It was, if I can't be a professional dancer, God forbid, I am not failing twice. So if I pick up this second career, and I mean, thank God for this second career. But really, I wasn't going to let, and this is possibly a little raw to say about myself, but I remember in the first 10 years, I was not going to let my old fellow dancers, my professors, my old directors, and my community see me fail. And certainly Mark saw it at home. The times where I should have failed, or I should have closed my doors, or I should have thrown in the towel. As a new business owner, especially in the service industry, and then on top of that, add female, primarily female human beings as your service industry and the families that come along with that, it was hard. And I'm not going to pretend that it was all cake in the sky. But I was not willing to fail. And I think I'm still, maybe it's because I didn't get that first dream, that I have four dreams left. And I have absolute confidence that when it's the right time, like Champagne just said, I will go to that next thing that I want to do. But I think it was born out of stubbornness at the beginning. I really do.
Yeah, and I think we talked a little bit about the gifts that our first career have given us. I think for me, being out as a kicker and failing and, you know, waking up the next morning and you're on the cover of the paper and you lost the game for the team and you've gone through that. We had an old coach with the Chargers in San Diego, Marty Schottenheimer, who always had this quote that he hung up in the locker room. It said that once you've walked in the rain, what's another drop? So once you've gone through it and you've seen it, for me, being a part of football has really prepared me to accept risk and not be afraid of failure, because you know that if you've done everything that you can to do it, the sun will rise the next day, regardless of how big your mess up may have been, and you'll move on and you'll learn from it. So I think that for me, that's one of the big things that I've received from playing professional football, is just embracing risk and knowing that, you know, the real great things are only accomplished through taking those sort of risks, and that if you happen to not succeed at it, you can just get up and move forward and get on with it, and everybody else will be fine with it eventually as well.
So loss and former failure made it easier to take those risks, do you feel?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because you know that the sun still comes up the next day?
Mm-hmm.
And we only have 1 minute left, and I want to ask you, Leslie, because you are preparing young people to follow the path that you followed, and your own oldest daughter is also an accomplished dancer and pursuing that dream. So as you send kids out into that world, how do you think about it? How do you deal with it? You're emotionally yourself to
right.
send them out to where things can be so hard and
well,
cruel.
I mean, the first feeling I get is I get tears in my eyes for the pride. I have so much pride. And when you see someone tell you what they want and they succeed at it, it just feels like, oh, this overwhelming joy that I have for these kids. And I just hope that all of the previous training and conversations, we have so many heart-to-heart conversations in our company, and they all know what else they're great at. And I think that's what I hope that they're holding on to, my daughter included. She's currently farther than I ever went as a dancer, but she knows what else she's great at. So I hope that will help her during the hard times, or God forbid, and I pray to God that all these dancers leave and have better knees than me. So, I mean, really, and these kids, and I said it before,
to prepare them to have something more to their identity than this one thing.
Absolutely. And continue to ask yourself, which is what we've sort of touched on, what do you want to do first? You know, you don't have to be this until you retire at 65 years old. What would you like to do first? And then keep the rest open.
We've been talking about first death and second life today. This show was inspired by a panel that took place at the Witching Hour Festival in Iowa City last fall. And with me this hour, Leslie Nolte, founder and artistic director of the Nolte Academy of Dance and Performing Arts Preschool in Coralville. Shumpa Yamaki, a potter, resident artist at Scattergood Friends School and Farm, and on the studio art faculty at Grinnell College. And Nate Kading, who's Iowa City Downtown District Retail Development Coordinator and a former professional football player, as well as a former Hawkeye football player as well. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.